Fran, are you happy to sit there as well?
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. As the chairman said, I come from the University of Oxford. I'm also an active member of the Women's Budget Group, which does gender analysis of budgets and public spending. And I was working at the Child Poverty Action Group when independent taxation was introduced. So I was around at that time as well. I'm going to focus on income tax and to some extent benefits, rather than inheritance tax and capital gains tax, which Stuart has already talked about. And I will try and answer the questions that were posed in the introductory note in your programme. I want to argue partly that we need clarity, because I don't think we always pose the issues in the most helpful and clear way. I want to say that I think we did get it in part right, introducing independent taxation, and that we're now getting it in part wrong by compromising that. And I want to put forward some priorities and principles and policies that we might pursue to tackle the real social issues that we think exist. So first of all, in terms of clarity and how we pose the issues, the very title of the debate today, I think, taxing families, is slightly odd. Perhaps tax and the family would be better. I mean, we tax income, we tax goods, indirect taxation we haven't talked about. But when taxing families is talked about, it's often in practice, if you drill down, referring to one-earner couples, usually with children, and sometimes only married or more recently only married couples and civil partners. So family taxation or taxing families often in the end actually means that. So I want to suggest A, that we call a spade, and B, that we think about all of the policies affecting families in that situation and not just taxation, and that we think about whether tax alone is a solution to the kinds of problems that those families face and whether it's the best solution. So the first question we were posed this evening was, should the transferable marriage allowance be extended or scrapped? My answer is it should be scrapped. Before 1990, there was the married man's allowance, as we've heard already today. It was described by one commentator as the extra money that a man got because he'd been through a marriage ceremony more recently than a divorce, which I thought was rather nice. Similarly, you could argue that the transferable tax allowance is the additional money that a higher-earning partner, 85% of whom are men, get because they have a partner with no taxable income or low taxable income, although they only get it, of course, as long as they're either married to them or living as a civil partner and they don't pay higher income tax. I think the transferable tax allowance was done for the wrong political reasons. It was apparently a trade-off in the coalition government for free school meals for 5 to 7-year-olds for the Liberal Democrats. I don't think it's working very well in the kind of way that Stuart's talked about in terms of take-up and so on, and what it does to incentives and marginal tax rates at the cliff edge. It's not really a recognition of marriage because many married couples don't get it. We stopped shaping the provision in our tax system around one-earner families in 2000, and we stopped doing that with the agreement of both main political parties. And I think we shouldn't have started again now on the principle of no or low earnings of one partner, because I think people would rather now be more than part of somebody else's taxable capacity. And I think particularly we shouldn't have done that by giving the higher earning partner, in practice, more money and thereby increasing the difference in income within that household, as well as creating disincentives for the other partner to earn their own income. Now, of course, because it's only £4 a week, that's not a huge issue at the moment. But in principle, any joint taxation system will create disincentives to the partner to earn their own income. I'm going to talk later about this, but if we're concerned about the fact that one partner in that couple has not got taxable income of their own, we might want to ask why that is the case, We might want to ask whether that should be of concern for public policy. And if it is a concern for public policy, we might want to ask whether extra money given to their partner is the best way to address that issue. And if it isn't, what other ways we might well address that instead. So I'll talk about that a bit later on. The second question we were asked was, has the higher income child benefit charge, which is sometimes called more accurately the higher income child benefit tax charge, undermined the principle of independent taxation? My answer would be yes, as has the transferable tax allowance as well, with no guarantee, of course, of support from the partner who's actually affected one way or the other. Child benefit is the recognition of family responsibilities in our fiscal system today. It isn't right to say our fiscal system doesn't recognise family responsibilities. We decided to introduce child benefit as a better way of recognising family responsibilities than the child tax allowances, which we had previously in conjunction with family allowances. And that's for several different reasons, which I have written about in the past and I'm not going to go into now. As with the transferable tax allowance, the high income child benefit charge complicates the tax system, as Stuart said. There's also a high marginal tax rate created, which rather illogically varies with the number of children you happen to have. It creates perverse incentives to convert your income to pension contributions and charitable giving and so on. And if you look at the tax cuts which happened at the same time are still happening, which benefit higher income taxpayers more, it tends to suggest there's a bit of a double standard between tax allowances for higher income people and child benefit for higher income people, which I personally am not sure we should encourage. The third question that we were asked is there a contradiction between individual assessment for tax and joint assessment for tax credits and benefits? My main point here would be, again, that we need clarity here, and there's often confusion in this debate as well, because many people see tax credits and means-tested benefits as the only existing benefits in our system until we get to universal credit. But in fact, other benefits are very much based on the individual. And in fact, this is increasingly the case. For example, the state pension and bereavement benefits have been redesigned recently so that you don't get the dependence allowance or you don't benefit as much from derived benefit rights from your spouse as has been the case in the past. You can also get contributory job seekers allowance, you get contributory employment and support allowance, you can get carers allowance if you're looking after somebody, and you can get maternity allowance if you're pregnant or just had a baby. There are quite a lot of individual benefits within our system. And the Chartered Institute of Taxation, in its report that Gillian's going to talk about, recognises two things which I think are very important. One is that an individual can be on low income, not just a household, and one is that resources may not be shared or shared equally within the household. And I think we have to take account of both those things. That's why the Women's Budget Group would argue that individual benefits are also important and that independent income for women may increase their voice within the household about the use of joint resources. So it isn't sufficient just to look at the joint resources of the household, but also to look at who might have their own income and what voice that gives them in the distribution and the use of those resources, whether that's individual income from benefit or earnings. And Holly Sutherland and I have written about how if you look at the abolition of the remaining non-means-tested benefits for income replacement, you would have quite a lot more couples in work poverty because their partner would not have an income. The last question we were posed is about the different definitions of a couple across the tax and benefit system. And of course, that doesn't just mean two definitions, but I'll leave that for Gillian. So I just wanted to finish by discussing a few principles and priorities and the policies that might lead to if we're considering tax and families. The first would be that we should look at tax and benefits and services together. As Don Draper quite rightly said, the example he gave would not be solved just by improving the tax position of that family. There were all sorts of other things going on, and I wouldn't necessarily start with income tax in terms of the issues that they were facing. I would also say we shouldn't necessarily assume the current relative priority on tax cuts and cuts to benefits and services that's happening at the moment, but that's a different issue. The case for independent taxation, I would say, is, if anything, stronger today in terms of chiming with people's aspirations and the need to recognise the multiplicity and fluidity of family forms. So, as I suggested, if the real issues are why has one partner got no taxable income of their own, and whether the tax and benefit system needs to do anything about that, given that actually all it may be about is just household production adding to the living standard of that family by unpaid labour, if there is a case of doing something about that, how best to do so? I think it's quite hard these days to justify support for one-earner couples without caring responsibilities, and I don't think people on this platform have been arguing for that. If the person does have caring responsibilities, then I would argue it's much better to ensure, for one thing, that child benefit is high enough. Child benefit is neutral in terms of family status. It's neutral in terms of employment status, so there are no problems of work disincentives. It's paid to the mother or the main carer, so it follows the child through all the changes in their lives. I would argue it should be paid to all families to recognise the additional costs that families with children face in comparison with other people, which is a horizontal distribution principle in taxation. If we think the better off should pay more tax, then we shouldn't just be picking on those who happen to have children at the moment, as the high income child benefit charge does. Any support for caring tasks is surely better directed at the carer themselves, not via their partner's tax allowance. So I would unfreeze child benefit, restore the universality, increase it in real terms. I would increase childcare support, which Don also talked about, probably via the providers rather than via the demand side. I would have more generous payment for parental leave with a right to return to work, which is important, and incentives to share the care between mothers and fathers. And I would improve the level of carers allowance, as they are doing in Scotland, in fact, for those caring for disabled and elderly people, with paid leave for those carers as well. So in conclusion, I wouldn't focus so much on the one-earner versus two-earner couples, whether they're married or not, as a key issue, or only on household income at one point in time. I would focus on children as the family responsibilities that really matter, and I would focus on the balance of resources within the household between partners, as well as the balance of resources between households, and I would also focus on the implications for roles and relationships and opportunities and income trajectories for individuals, not just now, but also over their life course. Thank you.